Thank you, Anna. Well, I had several interesting questions, comments, and a good little bit of instruction on having miscalled that lovely, coherent wave a, quote, sine wave, medically wrong, and perhaps electronically wrong. So simply think of it as a coherent wave. I wanted to make a kind of postscript for my chat with you about reconnecting to the light by telling you a little history of how these ideas actually unfold in an institutional setting. This is a very unusual group. You come from all over town, a number of different churches and many unchurched, as I was myself for so much of my life. I think that it's this commonality that makes us this particular group, this field of inquiry, this field of becoming. Does that field exist in a nascent way within the heavy structures and largely unconscious structures of a church? And I think the answer is yes. And I suspect that what has happened in my own church, All Saints by the Sea, may be possibly instructive. I kind of think we are an everyman sort of place. Well, the church is very charming, and it has a somewhat affluent congregation, which may pop it just slightly to the left of normal, but in almost every other respect, demographically, excuse me, we're about in the center. So this whole movement, so to speak, began in our church in the 90s. And it started in, I think, the way that a lot of new stuff gets started in churches. Churches regard new theological ideas the way the body regards a germ. And they treat it in just about the same way. All Saints received a large envelope from the Diocese of Los Angeles. The church secretary dutifully opened it, had a handsome flyer in it, quite an interesting letter of introduction. It was actually, it's a co-letter from the Diocese of Los Angeles, and also Wall Street, the Episcopal Church on Wall Street, Trinity Wall Street. Well, when you get something from Trinity Wall Street, you tend to pay attention. It's a remarkable landmark, but it's also a power institutionally and theologically in the U.S. Well, it seems that Wall Street had funded for the very first time in its foundation's history something to do with spiritual development. It always goes from Trinity Wall Street for profound social issues, you know, burning social issues. So this is going to deal something with a funding adventure in spiritual learning, spiritual development. And it was going to be run by a group from Baltimore, Maryland, who had a very good track record with using Quaker principles of listening, and it flew under the masthead of Listening Hearts. Our rector took one look at it, checked the flyer, read quickly through the letter, tossed the whole thing in the wastebasket. That evening, the church secretary went back, filched it out again, read the whole thing through, and the following morning she said, "Dennis, sit down. We're going to read this through together because I have the person who should run this project in this church." They read it together. He reluctantly acquiesced. I was called in the next week, looked at it, saw that it was going to be a major responsibility, but it spoke to my own heart. This was the path that I had already found myself on. Goody, I get to learn it sort of on stage, the way so much of my learning happens in my life. So we embarked on the 3-year program with Listening Hearts, and it was a remarkable program. A lot of training for its leaders, and a very prescripted unfolding of the program for 3 years. But essentially what it did was to give us the Quaker experience of connecting to the light. Learning to sit in silence to begin anything. We don't start with the agenda. We don't start with the issues. We simply sit in silence until we come into what today we are calling coherence. And then, and only then, we begin to discuss the issues. Well, of course, this has a profound effect on the way we prayed together, had a profound effect on the way we read Scripture together. And in fact, there are three or four very close friends in this group here, sitting with us, who were part of that beginning group. And we stumbled and learned together. At the end of the second year, I think, I went online to see who else was doing something like this and could I find any science about it. And I discovered HeartMath. HeartMath had just built its entire center up in Boulder Creek, and I was one of a group of 15 and had the experience that I told you about this morning of learning how to move into that coherent state. But I was thrilled with the science. And I went back again for another 2-week sojourn the following year. And from then on, I began looking at HeartMath, and I began then reading more and more widely, doing my own research. What happened at the end of those 3 years was that this particular group wanted to keep going. And we began to pour almost any content through the filter of this simple listening within, quelling our first response. Oh, that takes years to begin to be able to do. We all immediately know what we think, and we want to share it. So, nope, you don't go there. And perhaps the second round, we finally got disciplined enough so that by the time we got to number 3 on our own personal know-it-all agenda, we had forgotten it. We were listening to the arising of insight within us. Insight is a process of spirit and intelligence, and we're meant to live in its flow. But mostly we don't, because we block it off. So that at the end of we did this for 7 years, and then we just didn't need to do it anymore. It wasn't that we weren't doing it. We had inculcated it. It was as if we had in our ear, hitting this thing, one of those little Bluetooth devices. Remember when they were walking around with those earphones? It's as if we're tuned in to that inner quiet insight process, even as we're doing the dishes, running the meeting, having a conversation, making a decision. To the extent that we could come in at a lower level of affect, what am I doing?
It's coming into your sleep.
There.
There you go.
One of the originals. Still an original. Oh, that's much better, Candace. Thank you. Thank you, Camille. So, having this sort of little inner feed is what we were able to walk out with. It's not that we're in touch all the time. It's that we know how to move into silence and to attach that. The ground was ready at the end of 7 years, and by about the 9th year, a whole roll of small, low-level new activities were beginning to happen at All Saints. We began to develop a group in centering prayer. Not just our group, but we were always the core, but more and more people came in to learn centering prayer. Then we moved out into the creation of a completely new service for people who never came to church on Wednesday evenings. It's still going. It's called Eventide. We sit in the chancel. We chant. We have a wonderful half hour of very, very simple worship, a soup supper, then a little learning session that is always about some form of spiritual practice. As the pilot for that group got itself established, we decided that we would do a 3-week pilot. Service, soup supper, and some kind of really worthwhile education. What should it be? Well, let's look at prayer. So for 3 weeks, we looked at prayer, and more people began to come each week to the service and stay after for the class. At the end of that 3 weeks, nobody wanted to stop. Let's start the service again in September, and let's continue with the class in prayer. But what kind of prayer? They all said the thing I knew the least about, healing prayer. However, in the company of the good woman who just came up to try to, take care. How's this? Okay, yay. We undertook to teach ourselves about healing touch. We found that there was another church, Trinity Church, equally interested in healing touch, and we made a two-church project. Again, a three-year church project that is now in its 10th year. And between these churches, we now have, is it 11 or 12, fully trained healing touch practitioners who run clinics at Trinity Church and run single parishioners at All Saints. It's a robust, small, but robust and coherent program. And the final piece that it just sort of blossomed into was a rework with the Quaker process, this time with Parker Palmer's work. We had spent about 3 to 4 years just reading his books and moving along with that form of listening. This last year we did it through the election months, Healing the Heart of Democracy, and then Sacred America, which we all did together last fall. Hard to live through those months. And thank you. And learning that not only did we live with the two polarities of our parties, but that we ourselves are born with the two polarities within us. So we learned a lot through this quiet listening. So from the wastebasket effect to 12 to 14 years later, slowly the ground level, the groundwater has just begun to touch a lot of other ministries. We're still very small with these things, but person by person comes in, comes across from another church, stays with us for a while. We hold hands as well with St. Mark's up in the San Ynez Valley. This is the way I think the new paradigm starts, not with a parade down Fifth Avenue. It starts small, listening, deeply following that guidance and seeing where it leads us. So that is, for me, sort of the test tube version of this paradigm that we're on the cusp of, that Phyllis Tickle has been telling us about. It's all about reconnecting with the light, but it's also all about these embodied intelligences and listenings that we're learning how to do again. So, questions. I know you have questions, comments. If you'll come, please be brief so that many of us will have a chance to just weigh in and share where we are with this subject. So, open for questions.
Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
This is off the wall, but it just came to me while you were talking. First of all, I always love it when I hear about the coherence of a 60-watt bulb boring a hole through the sun. Amazing. And the coherence of each of us, if we're coherent, interacting with those around us. We've all experienced in earlier years, especially, we've all experienced when we're incoherent, when we're frustrated and irritable, and how contagious that is. Yes. But the coherence being contagious is the hope for the world. But then, now this is the part that's very dark, but I've always wondered, especially now in my journey, where does evil come from? And, you know, if you read the daily Richard Rohr stuff, he would say that when people do evil, it's because they're seeking love. And it's not that they're evil. But it occurred to me that, you know, we have focused on coherence with the intention of good. But perhaps, and thus you are a co-creator, but perhaps coherence with the opposite intention is the source of true evil. You know, like real bad spirits. Yeah.
Yeah. We are born into a dualistic world. The polarities exist in our parties. They exist in our families. Research has shown that they are literally DNA wired within us. It follows from generation to generation in families. It's part of the game that we, somewhere, our souls agreed to play when we came into this particular world, onto this particular game board. So that, oh yes, the out-of-phase behavior can gather collectively and cause a lot of damage. But because it is not for the good of the whole, it cannot attain that kind of coherence. It can be a big collective, and it can get money, and it can get voice, but it doesn't get coherence. No. I think it can do lots of things, lots of strengths, but coherence comes out of, only out of this heart-based chemistry. And it cannot go against itself. It can't. Yeah. Yes, next.
I come out of Baptist history, and a group of us many years ago got into spiritual direction, and then we were trained as spiritual directors. But in our Baptist world, were we ever suspect?
Oh, yes.
We were suspect. So I say to you, Christian theology and what you were into, did you experience a lot of you're way out there, lady, and you're suspect? Did you get a lot of that?
Oh, it's the story of my life, darling. I've been working so far out on the edge professionally, and there are other good friends in this an auditorium that will remember some of those days. So, yes. And I think the whole business of this kind of work is that if I keep getting pulled by my caller to do something, it is an inner prompting, and I always say yes. So, yes, there's just lots of pushback all the time. It's partly what I measure now our, quote, success by. Yes.
I was going to say that the first class I took in Healing Touch, a woman said, the teacher said, 19 years ago I was fired from this hospital for speaking about, in the doctor's lounge, what they'd have now hired me to teach.
Ah. Yeah. Lag time, 19 years. Yes.
Thank you so much. I just wondered if there's a connection with Healing Touch and Reiki. Is it the same thing, or was that part of your study?
Actually, I did study Reiki before I came to Healing Touch, and I moved to Reiki as as a result of my training as a spiritual director with Stillpoint. When we were finished with that, one of our number was a Reiki practitioner, and said, I find so many parallels between what we're attempting to do and what my practice of Reiki leads me to do. I wonder if any of you would be at all interested in just taking a very shortened course in Reiki, and then if you're really interested, then I will assist you in getting a first-degree Reiki, and some of us actually got a second-degree Reiki, but at that point, our Japanese capacities to pronounce the words and use them had just failed. So when Healing Touch came along, I discovered that it's very similar. Energy is energy. But they are two beautiful stories that come from two parts of the world. The devout Japanese monk who believed that what he had read in scripture was true and wanted to prove it, to make it happen. He's the one who created that whole Reiki process. It's so Japanese, so beautiful, ritualistic. It's a lovely thing. And it's simpler versions, I think, are used in the U.S. All the time, so that at the heart, of course, they spring out at the same thing, but their forms are just slightly different and beautifully so.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Hi, Pat. I want to thank you for sharing with us your experience at your church by reintroducing the more heart-centered way of praying and centering prayer. And it reminded me, and it gives me hope, because when Thomas Keating came to the Mind Supermind 17 years ago, one of the last questions that was put in front of him was, how do you see the future of Christianity? And his answer was, unless it grows up from the childish interpretation it is practicing now, I see no hope for it. And that was big. And when I hear what you're saying, and you've been doing it for 10 years at your church, it's the beginning of the turnaround. And I think that is the way the churches are going to refill, and as opposed to emptying as they are now. But will the churches cooperate and accept that the mystical element is missing and too much duality? So I think it's wonderful, and it's a coming together of everything, of the body, the mind, the heart, all religions, that this is fostering, and the unity that the world is lacking right now. So anyway, thank you.
Well, thank you. That was very wonderfully comprehended and said. What is happening here in Santa Barbara is exemplified in this room. We come from many different traditions. We're all, most of us at any rate, are Christians. The rest of us are good souls who believe in wholeness, which is what the Quakers did. I married into a Quaker family, the McClure boys all went to Haverford College. And when I asked my father-in-law, being sort of, still in my more religious time of my life, what he considered to be sort of the ultimate spiritual state, and I wasn't looking for him to say saved. No, I had gone way past that. But I had perhaps another term in mind. And he stopped, thought for a moment, and he said, it's wholesomeness. That has stayed with me all my life as really perhaps the very best answer to my question that I have ever received. So it is this cross-threading, this cross-loom that we are weaving. Everywhere around us, ecumenical efforts are collapsing like soap bubbles. It was so big and so important and so needed a few decades ago. But it's somehow not as needed now, because we've already learned that we are closer to each other than we had thought. We seem to have gone through that particular growth spurt. As a collective now, we are beginning to look at interfaith work, aren't we? And we do a lot of that here at Word and Life. But ultimately, that is where we are headed. Now, whether our discrete institutions can get there or not, I don't know. My own little denomination, and it's very small compared to the big ones, the gigantic Catholic group, the big Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Methodists, you know, these are all heavy hitters. In comes the collared Episcopalian with its wild-eyed ideas socially and its groundbreaking rules about everybody being invited to the table, every sex is invited, etc. I love it. It just delights me. And yet, I find it's also stymieing ourselves, sort of stepping on the hems of our own gowns with the kind of political correctness that seems to have come along on the tails of this behavior. So we have our own problems, absolutely, as everybody does. But it's this coherent sitting down together, moving into silence, that allows us to come out somewhere in the same part of the stream. It always works. Yes. Christine, I think you're next. And then come up from the back first. You've been waiting there. And then Christine.
The assistant manager at where I live has a whiteboard outside her office, and she puts up quotes and things. And one of the things was on the board this past week said, truth goes through three phases. First, it is ridiculed, and that is opposed, and then it is considered self-evident.
Perfect. I think that that is absolutely right. Thank you,
Hi.
Christine.
I want to see if you can clarify and bring something into integration for me and for anybody else who's interested. I hope I can say this the right way. You said coherence comes through to the heart. I mean, that's where it comes into coherence. And then we're all connected, and this is where I'm having an issue with sometimes. We are connected, but it's free will to choose to be connected in this love. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think so.
Because I don't think evil can go, like you said, it's opposite of love, whatever the reason is for that evil. And you can discuss evil, but how can that be part of connectedness to the heart of love? Does that make... In other words, there's a theory and a religious view and a theoretical view. Everybody is connected. We're all connected. But then when you bring in the coherence of the heart, and then somebody addressed evil, and then I heard you say, see if I can, I can't verbalize exactly what you said, but basically it was you can't be do evil or have evil and be in the heart.
Yes.
Okay. So then, therefore, people that are not within love or doing the heart are not as necessarily connected in love. We're not all connected in the same way. Is that?
Well, we may not be connected in, quote, love,
or
but
the life.
We are absolutely connected biochemically,
yes.
Energetically. We are, I don't know if anyone is reading this marvelous new book about trees from the German author.
Right.
And
connecting with each
other. The discovery that all the trees on the planet are, in fact, one organism. And to discover that extraordinary truth biologically, et cetera, with all of its implications, makes us, of course, think about ourselves. The great quote that I remember from many, many years ago, speaking about the trees and bushes on the planet, refers to that life form as the other great tribe. So these two great tribes, one afoot, one rooted, I believe are nevertheless all deeply, deeply connected. When I ran a little program on the nature of evil, I went to the Oxford Dictionary. I love to look at the semantics behind words, and I like to dig down as far as I can. So I get out my magnifying glass. I heave the huge volume up onto the table. I go to evil. There are three or four pages on evil.
Wow.
So you just simply start and you simply begin moving through. What's interesting is that the second in this endless list that goes over four pages, a definition of evil was out of pattern.
That's, I think you're saying the same thing, that you're not in the same pattern, but you're connected in some way, but you're not in the same pattern of the heart and receiving the same essence.
Right. Out of pattern, out of sync, and determined to continue with that behavior, which is damaging, curiously satisfying. There's nothing that is as satisfying as self-righteousness, whether it's on the one side or the other. So what do we do with a pattern that has
right.
ripped in a weaving? We attempt to pull it back together again.
So the intention is what's important.
The intention, it turns out, is far more important than we knew. We may want to look at intention as a group. I don't know how many of you read the work of Lynn McTaggart. Lynn McTaggart lives in London, but she's a brilliant American science journalist who keeps up with all the leading edge work in science and writes books about them. She wrote a best-selling book called The Field, and it describes the zero-point vacuum world, which has a great deal to do with contemporary theology. She followed it with a book on the power of intention. So I'm thinking about the practitioners of the heart math process, holding their little petri dishes with the DNA winding in the submerged in the water, and their use of intention. I've read, I don't know, hundreds of studies about intention and healing, and they all come out with exactly the same answer, that the addition of clear, consistently held intention acts, because it's out of consciousness, the energy of consciousness, acts like a laser beam, and it will pull out of the tumble of ordinary creation, it will pull a new pattern to it. Mm. So the power of intention has started a huge worldwide project in intention, and you can find it through Lynn McTaggart's homepage, I think, and you can follow online and see what the reports are that are coming in around the world about the use of, you know, mind, consciousness, and intention.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Comments, questions? We have about 5 minutes left. I'd love to hear anything else. Yes, please.
What was the title of the book you mentioned about trees?
The Intention Experiment. Oh, about trees. Hey, Candace, it's just called Trees, isn't it? Oh, Jackie. The Hidden Life of Trees. Do you recall the author, Jackie? So, sorry. The Hidden Life of Trees. Look it up. It's a wonderful book. Well, let me close by talking for just a minute about something that has been suggesting itself through our question and answer time. I can remember thinking about John Philip Newell's phrase, the rebirthing of Christianity, and thinking that birth comes after conception. And we've been talking a lot about our conception of light. We talked about the old conception of light that we mostly had, and how this new information changes our conception of light. What we have done is to move this morning behind conception to what comes before that. And what comes before that within the brain-mind system is perception. The way we see things leads to our conclusions about the state of the reality around us. Jean Houston coined an amusing little couplet that I have remembered and used in all the years since. She said, "Percept louses up concept." And indeed it does. Percept louses up concept. If we don't see clearly, wholly, we are very likely to build a belief or a reality picture out of just part of the information, and it's going to be crippled and leaning to one side as we move along with it. How do we see as clearly as possible? Well, we move past those old brain survival systems that close down intelligence, close it down to its manageable, safe running, and we move into the heart, which is connected, as I have told you in the past, to all the information fields around it, not only those that are physical and emotional and real to us, but at some level of subtlety, those waves move into what Niels Bohr called the non-local arena of energy. At some point, he said, the mind, looking at the experiment with particle and wave, the way in which we look is what determines what we see. Percept determines the way we want to, the pattern that we want to see. But he said, the truth is that there is nothing there. There is ultimately no particle. It's all just energy. It's all just energy. And it is energy that is constantly coming into form. And at its apex and largest expression, it is consciousness. So that is the perception that we've brought to the room this morning. And when we look through that perception, our conceptions of light have widened and deepened and made new connections for us. So I urge all of you to move into that place of perception that's connected with the heart and brain and trained with all the fields there are, and see how that changes the way you see your world. Thanks for taking this walk with me this morning.
Thank you so much, Pat, for the whole session. It was just marvelous. People were spellbound here, listening and watching. I want to thank Pat, and I want to thank the Brown Group. You did an excellent job of bringing food for us today. And then next week is Orange. If you have an Orange ticket, it's your week. And next week we have Reverend Susan Copeland, who spends time on Iona every year. So please come and listen to her. Thanks, Pat.